New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing. Always cutting-edge information, peer-reviewed literature, good science showing us the way to live longer and healthier lives. Then my guest in a half hour will be talking about taking on the coal industry and its lies about clean coal propaganda. That'll be Peter Bull. He's an award-winning independent director, television producer, and his work with PBS, ABC, CNBC, and Discovery. And in fact, he was a senior producer for the Public Affairs Program, now with Bill Moyers. We're also going to do a little commentary from Con Halliman, a foreign policy and focus on the U.S. has lost in Afghanistan. We have to come to grips with that and what it means. This is in contrast to what you'll be hearing about the spin of us winning in Iraq and how everything is better. Every day, twice a day, I'll be doing commentaries to challenge the official point of view. Let's go to the latest on health and healing. A lot of people use talcum powder. You shouldn't. In fact, every year approximately 13,000 women die of ovarian cancer with 21,000 new cases reported each year. What makes ovarian cancer so deadly is the fact that it's a silent disease. Many women won't even know they have it until it's too late. For years, people have known that there are several risk factors for getting ovarian cancer: being overweight, hormonal replacement therapy, fertility drugs. But there's another risk factor that the majority of the public isn't aware of: talcum powder. Talcum powder is widely used from the time we are infants all through adulthood. And the makers of these talc products, those who make baby BP products and women's personal care products, the makers of latex products, all know of the dangers but refuse to put it on the label. Scientists have known since the late 1960s that talc is dangerous. In one study done in 1971, researchers found particles of talc in 75% of the ovarian tumors they studied. In another study done by 19 scientists in 8 different countries, research showed that there is up to 60% increased risk of ovarian cancer if talc is used in the genital area. Study after study for the last 50 years shows that talc is dangerous. Johnson & Johnson said in an article in 1982 they were aware of the many publications on the dangers of talc powder, and they were aware of a specific publication that said that, quote, the frequent genital application of talc was responsible for a 300% increase in risk of ovarian cancer. If you check the National Cancer Institute's website and search ovarian cancer, it even comes up under risk factors that talc powder is known to cause ovarian cancer. So why aren't there warning labels on products containing talc? It's because the United States Food and Drug Administration, one of the most corrupt organizations in American history, does not think this is a real issue, despite all the many studies. That's what money buys you in Washington. It buys you FDA approval, no matter if you have a known killer. So we could say this: the FDA supports the unnecessary death of women. So the next time someone in your family gets ovarian cancer, think of it this way: what if they had been warned? Then again, we have to realize we're dealing with the FDA. My God, they should shut that agency down and fire every single employee. And we could start from scratch and do it right this time. Water before meals helps with weight loss, according to this research at a national meeting of the American Chemical Society. Drinking 2 glasses of water before each meal will help you to lose more weight. Quote, we are presenting results of the first randomized controlled intervention trial demonstrating that increased water consumption is an effective weight loss strategy. That's according to a Dr. Brenda Davey, senior author of the study. In this recent study, we found that over the course of 12 weeks, dieters who drank before meals 3 times a day lost 5 pounds more than dieters who did not increase their water intake. Well, the philosophy behind this suggests that by consuming more water, there's less room in the stomach for food. So in essence, the zero-calorie beverage takes the place of food, which results in less calorie consumption and less additional pounds. However, all participants in the study ate low-calorie foods as part of the study, and all lost the same weight. But those who drank water before their meals lost more. Research also noted that water is better than sodas and other sweetened beverages that are loaded with sugar or artificial sweeteners. Too much meat, not good for you. Not enough fruit, not good for you. The average American consumer eats significantly too much meat and refined carbohydrates like bread and not enough fruits and veggies. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. The USDA estimates food consumption by tracking how much food is produced and circulating through the food system, then adjusting that for losses such as spoilage and inedible parts of the food. And then they come up with how much we're eating per person. Well, meat consumption is 20% higher than recommended, and that's assuming that a person should be eating 88 ounces of meat per serving. But here's the real math, and this is why you can't trust government statistics. 1 ounce is 28.35 grams. Okay, so what we have is we have how much protein should you have at a given serving? About 1 ounce if it's 28.35 grams protein. So let's say if you're a woman, that's actually twice, that's one half of your total daily supply. If you're a man, that would be 1 ounce three times a day, which means, now visualize this, if you went into a restaurant, and if we were doing this accurately and honestly, we would say you can have one forkful, just one forkful of a small bite of meat, if you were getting your meat as your primary source or your only source of protein. Well, needless to say, no one's going to go into a restaurant and lay out some money to buy one single fork. That's the smallest of small, even if you are into haute cuisine and they give you tiny little portions. But that's how much you require, which means it really way massively over consuming the amount of meat in our diet. And then they're saying that we're consuming 20% more above and beyond that. Quote, and the dietary recommendations aren't exactly skimpy on meat, according to this. But when it comes to eating fruits and veggies, there we really go downhill. We're just not eating enough. In fact, the average American eats only about 1.5 servings of vegetables a day, and that's only because French fries and ketchup were added in under the Reagan administration as veggies. They're not, but you get the point. Now, from Ethan Huff and from Genome Research, the peer-reviewed journal, and some serious research here, here's what they're doing. I thought it was interesting from the Institute of Medicine. It says, vitamin D really does prevent cancer and autoimmune diseases. Quote, a study out of Oxford University pinpoints vitamin D deficiency as the culprit in serious illnesses like cancer and autoimmune disorders. This is according to the latest report, because it impacts genetic receptors throughout the body that need adequate vitamin D levels to prevent these and other serious illnesses from developing. We're also talking about multiple sclerosis, diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, and leukemia. These and many more diseases are often caused by a lack of vitamin D. Your genes literally have receptors that need vitamin D in order to properly express themselves. And if there's not enough of the vitamin D, serious illness is going to happen. So, make sure you're getting 2,000, 3,000 units a day of vitamin D, or about a half hour of sunlight over half your body a day. Either way, you need it. And prescription painkillers, now gateway drugs to hard drug use. This is something interesting from the University of Buffalo. And here's what it says. Again, these are not articles that I find in the mainstream media. These are from the actual scientific publications out there. Quote, shocking new research out of the University of Buffalo has revealed that popular prescription opiate medications are causing people to become addicted to street drugs. Once addicted, nearly half of the patients prescribed opiate pain pills end up transitioning to street drugs like heroin, because these drugs are generally cheaper and are easier to obtain. of 75 patients hospitalized at Erie County Medical Center in Buffalo, New York, for detoxification, over 41% told their doctors they became addicted to street drugs after being prescribed opiate medications like methadone, oxycodone, and others. 92% of all patients in the program indicated these prescription opiates actually led them to street drugs. Quote, this information suggests there is a progressive nature to opiate use, and that prescription opiates can be the gateway to illicit drug addiction. That's according to Dr. Richard Blondell, MD, professor of family medicine, senior author of this study. And finally, the demand for food is costing the earth. This is from the Telegraph. The fight is on over how to solve the global crisis. Hardly a morning passes without food making the headlines. This week has brought us the burger that thinks it's a pizza news that eating asparagus helps us stay slim. And we have heard that if you eat pickled squid guts and single cream together, it tastes like strawberry shortcake. However, this month has also seen reports on escalating wheat and coffee prices due to bad weather and poor harvest. Then on June 19th came the headline, Australian mining giant launches hostile $40 billion takeover for the world's biggest potash supplier. It's not immediately apparent what we're talking about here, but this is City Champagne bar speak for world runs out of food. This really is news about food that consumers should be fearful of. So listen up, everyone. The takeover sprung upon Potash Corporation of Canada by BHP Billiton of Melbourne, Australia, is a seismic shift in the future of food. Demand for potash, a mineral salt that is mined and used as crop fertilizer, has risen because the world needs to produce more food to feed an increasing population. There's limited land for cultivation. Added to this is the rising wealth of highly populated countries like Asia, with a growing appetite for meat. If you want to produce a lot of meat, you need a lot of grain. 7 kilograms for every kilogram of beef. That's a very poor math, because it means that you're wasting 6 kilograms of grain to get back 1 of beef, rather people eat that 7 grains. And the broad view is that to achieve this, you need large quantities of potash and fertilizer, and this is a finite quantity of naturally occurring potash or potassium carbonate in the Earth's crust. You can manufacture by burning down forests of broadleaf trees, but let's not go there. Digging it out of the ground is the agribusiness preferred option. Meanwhile, to produce the nitrogen for fertilizer, you need to burn an awful lot of crude oil. Yep, the world is going to look like a perforated airflow golf ball by the time we finish with it. Every government needs to pay attention to what is happening, but they are not. In the United States, when the President of the United States eats junk food and hamburgers, as if there is no discipline, smokes cigarettes and drinks alcohol, if there is no concern of the image this sends, with all these state dinners, the bigger the meal, whether it's beef or corned beef or whatever food it is, you would think that someone, somewhere, at some point, at some time in the history of our government would actually have a little bit of ethics, a little bit of brains, and a whole lot of compassion for the earth. Trouble is, they don't. I wish they did. They don't. So, now, what do we do? Well, what do? We do what we've done. We take a careful look around and say, if you wait for the government to help you in anything, you're waiting too long and it's not going to happen. So start looking to become vegan. That's conscious raising. Go organic. That's higher. Buy locally grown produce from farmers markets. That's also good. Try to sell your assets and move to property that is sustainable with progressive people within your nearby community. That's a good future. Or stay exactly where you're at and believe all the tripe coming out of Washington. You're just going to be waiting for Godot. Because there's no way in the world anyone in Washington is ever going to do anything that actually is ethically important for the benefit of the planet and the people on it. And we all know that. So we've got to just give up on the system as it is now and start fresh with people who have some ideals. people who haven't forgotten what it is to be honest, and people who care for one another. Those are my thoughts. I stand behind them. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Listening to the number one listened to radio program in the world for independent and progressive minds. No, we're not left. I don't believe in wearing soiled underwear. And we're not right. I don't believe in running through public naked. We are people who have brains, minds, hearts, and souls and are willing to share positive solutions for the world we're coming up into. My guest in about 12 minutes now, Peter Bull, will talk about taking on the coal industry and its fraudulent clean coal propaganda. Again, you'll need to know this stuff. Right now, we're going to go over because we have Lou Panessi on our line, and then I'm going to do a commentary. The U.S. has lost in Afghanistan. We have to come to grips with what that means from Con Hallinan, Foreign Policy in Focus. Hi, Lou Ann.
Hey, Gary. I got to tell you, you've piqued the interest of quite a bit of your audience here with this whole idea of finding sustainable land and the whole concept of homesteading. I've been getting a lot of emails lately having people asking about the whole homestead project. They're asking, where is it? When does it start? When can we get going with it? So obviously there are a lot of people listening.
I believe that we have 8 different economies. From the very powerful elite who don't have to work and don't have to worry about food or sustainability, to the very poorest in our society. But the people who are going to be mostly affected are approximately 107 million working adults. And then we have about 22 million people working in the government, state, federal, and local. That's part of our problem. We have bloated bureaucracies that do nothing that is functionally beneficial in the larger context for making life better for the planet so that we don't have all this lobbying, we don't have the corruption, we don't have allowing major corporations to define the law and define ethics from their own terms, like British Petroleum and all of its bad closed down oil rigs. I think it has over 700 out of 24,000 in the Gulf of Mexico alone. So I believe that we should start looking now, over the next 2 years, to deconstructing much as we can our life where we live and looking for more idealistic places to live that have water and soil, are not at the ocean, are not on a fault line like in California for an earthquake, are not in Hurricane Valley or Tornado Valley, and not up in the high country where it's going to burn your house and everything with it if there's a fire, but rather the 16 areas, 16 principal states where you're not overly congested, where you have quality input. And I'm working towards showing people how that can be done, whether it's just a family wants to buy a second home or have a second home where, as they retire or as they can afford to, they can make the transition, where others who are single can look for communities that are better to live in. I was just in Sedona. That's not a better community to live in. That's not sustainable. They're coming down on the wrong side of history at this point of being in the right place. They're not. I can't tell you how many people out there are on hard times where 10 years ago they weren't. The same is true in, out in Taos, New Mexico, The same is true in Santa Fe. So I will be doing a lot on homesteading. And anyone interested in homesteading should give a call. And as I do workshops and as I show people the best places in America to live, depending upon what you can do, where you want, if you're single or family person, if you're younger or older, if you have children or not, there are all these variables. But once you get through all the variables, then I believe that you can have a quality of life. So no matter what they do in Washington or elsewhere on Wall Street, you're not going to get blindsided. I believe our currency is going to take a thumping in the next 2 years. I believe the real estate market is going to drop between 30 to 50% from where we're at right now over the next 24 months. I believe that urban and suburban crime is going to become epidemic. I believe social unrest is inevitable. And I believe that we're going to see some substantial quality changes in the infrastructures. We're already seeing it. I predicted it 2 years ago. Now we're seeing where streetlights are turned off in cities, the police helicopters being sold off, fire departments are being pulled back, and once idyllic places like Summit, New Jersey and Rumson, New Jersey are no longer good places to live because of the influence of an out-of-control crime sprees. So that's what it's about, and I will keep people posted. If people want information, I don't have a phone number to give them because I'm on the road filming, and I'm way far away from everyone.
Well, who do you want them to call? I'll find their number.
Well, let's see. Today is let me do this. Let me get a phone number, get someone they can call, at least so I can be in touch with them when I come back to the United States, when I'm back where I can talk with people. And let's do this tomorrow, all right?
Excellent.
Come on tomorrow, and we'll tell people, especially down in Washington, D.C., where I'll do I have a meeting there with the vets, homeless vets organizations in October. Might be a good time to meet with people in that area who would like to know sustainable future. Where are the best places to live? Where the career is going to be? The ways of looking at, investments, etc. Thanks a lot, Luann.
Okay, Gary. Thank you.
All the best to you.
Bye-bye.
Now, for a short commentary, then we'll go to our guest. Wars are rarely lost in a single encounter. Defeat is almost always more complex than that. The United States and its North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, have lost the war in Afghanistan. But not just because they failed in the battle for Marja or decided that discretion was a better part of valor in Kandahar. They lost the war because they should never have invaded in the first place. Because they never had a goal that was achievable. Because their blood and capital are finite. The fact of the defeat was everywhere this past month. According to Afghanistan Rights Monitor, quote, in terms of insecurity, 2010 has been the worst year since the demise of the Taliban regime in 2001. A recent U.S. government audit found that despite $27 billion spent on training, fewer than 12% of Afghan security forces were capable of operating on their own. Some 58% of the American public think the war is a lost cause, and 60% think the United States should begin to withdraw in July of 2011. Only Republicans vote in Congress save the Obama administration request for $33 billion to fuel the war in the coming fiscal year. The war is currently hemorrhaging money at a rate of $7 billion a month, and most of that is lost. The British public, the United Kingdom, is the second largest armed contingent in Afghanistan, opposed the war by 72%. And other coalition forces are quickly abandoning the effort in the war-torn Central Asian nation. Poland announced it would withdraw its 2,600 troops next year. The Dutch will be out this August. The Canadians also within 12 months. The Australians, along with the rest of NATO allies, declined a plea in July to send more combat troops. In a sign of the dire circumstances, the war effort, twice this past month, Afghan soldiers turned their guns on NATO soldiers. A poll by the International Council on Security and Development reaffirms that the NATO alliance is failing to win over Afghan civilians, a cornerstone of success in the current strategy employed in Afghanistan. The poll found that in the two provinces currently at the center of the war, Helmand and Kandahar, 75% of Afghans believe foreigners disrespect their religion and tradition. 74% of Afghans think working for foreign forces is wrong, and 68% believe NATO will not protect them. And 65% think Taliban leader Mullah Omar should be part of a government. So it's the arithmetic of defeat. So does one calculate the arithmetic of defeat? But defeat does not mean the war is over. Indeed, the moment when it becomes obvious that victory is no longer an option can be the most dangerous time in a conflict's history. The losers may double down, as the French and the United States did in Vietnam. They may lash out in a frenzy of destruction, as the United States did in Laos and Cambodia. Or they may poison the well for generations to come by dividing the people on the basis of ethnicity, religion, and tribe, as the British did when their empire began to disintegrate. Faced with rising opposition at home, increased casualties on the battlefield, and growing isolation from its allies, the United States is casting about for a way to salvage the Afghan disaster and coming up with schemes that may end up destabilizing not only Afghanistan, but much of Central and South Asia. The most radical of these schemes is being floated by the former U.S. ambassador to India, Robert Blackwell, a neoconservative mainstay and currently a lobbyist for India. Blackwell proposes partitioning Afghanistan into two countries, an independent Pashtun-dominated south and a northern-western section where Tajiks and Uzbeks and Hazaras make up the majority. According to the scheme, that you would need about 30 or 40,000 U.S. troops there constantly. Well, such an independent country would almost certainly destabilize Pakistan's northern frontier and tribal areas where 40 million Pashtuns currently reside. Many of those Pashtuns have never accepted the 1893 Durand Line that the British used to divide Afghanistan from what was then India. Also, you have to understand that you can't just continue to do things as if you know what is right and the rest of the world does not. A second proposal to create an army of local militias to fight the Taliban is already underway, in spite of the disastrous experience with similar armed groups during the Soviet occupation. Those militias turned into warlord armies, which shook down local residents, protected the group's drug business, and fought over tribal turf. U.S. Commander David Petraeus insists that the armed groups will not be militia, but more like police, uniformed, armed, and paid by the government of President Hamid Karzai. But given that the Kabul government has virtually no presence outside the capital, how these groups will be controlled is not obvious. Furthermore, if for some reason these militias do confront the Taliban, they will be outgunned by more experienced guerrilla fighters. A June 9th incident in Kandahar is a case in point. The Taliban attacked a local militia that had gathered to celebrate a wedding, killing 40 and wounding 87. The unit had been recruited by U.S. Special Forces, which promised weapons and ammunition. But according to the New York Times, when militia commander Muhammad Nabi Keiko went into the Special Forces, the commander followed him off to the Karzai regime, which turned down his request. Whether from fear of forming independent militias or plain old corruption is not clear. When the Taliban attacked, the militia could not defend itself. The United States has a long track record of recruiting local people, fighting and then abandoning them. They did it in Vietnam and the Highlands. They did it among the Hmong and Laos. The model that has the most parallels with the situation in Afghanistan, however, is Guatemala, where the United States helped the military dictatorship create village militias to fight insurgents. If the militias did not fight the guerrillas, the Guatemalan army slaughtered the villagers. If the militias did fight, the villagers became targets in a long-running civil war. Indeed, an argument can be made that the very idea of militias violates the Geneva Convention against using civilians to fight in a war, although the United States could finesse that argument by claiming the militia members were uniformed. What is certain is that entire villages will be pulled into the war by making them targets for retaliation by more experienced and better armed Taliban. Keep in mind, Taliban don't forget anything. they have all the patience in the world. They can wait another 30 years, 40 years, and every single year they wait, we get more and more fractured. We drain more resources. So we close schools in the United States, okay, and we give corrupt generals in Afghanistan and Iraq the money. Well, does anyone care? We can't feed hungry children, 13 million hungry children in the United States, could have been hungry each day, but we make sure that the warlords, the drug lords, the people growing the poppies to make into heroin, that they have all that they need. Does anybody care? I haven't seen that. We don't have healthy infrastructure in the United States, from dams to dikes to levees, to bridges and tunnels and gas and water mains. And our environment is completely polluted, air, water, and soil. But that doesn't stop us from making sure that the religious leaders and the Sunni awakening have all the best guns, munitions, and plenty of money to spend however they wish with no accountability. At last count, there's over $10 billion in cash missing alone in Iraq. Is anyone concerned? And that's where we stand. Are they going to be living with depleted uranium in Iraq? Are they going to be worried about their child being born with birth defects? Do they have a concern that only 10% of the population in Iraq can actually have electricity for more than 8 hours a day? No. No, that's what happens when you live in the gilded cage of Washington, D.C. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Years every week on PFW in Washington, D.C., and the people know what to expect from our programs. We try to find guests that you're not seeing on the normal talk circuit. We try to take on issues that are not aligned with the left or the right, but are of independent mind. Taking on the coal industry is the topic, and it's clean coal propaganda. My guest is Peter Bull. I gave a mention at the beginning. I'll repeat what I said. He is an award-winning independent documentary filmmaker, television producer, and writer, credited with many specials on PBS, ABC, CNBC, and Discovery. And he is also the author of several important investigative films, including his work on Frontline's Hot Topics. His most recent documentary, produced by the Center for Investigative Reporting, is Dirty Business: Clean Coal and the Battle for Our Energy Future, which has received an Appy Award. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
Great to be here, Gary.
Peter, I was concerned when candidate Obama, and before candidate Obama, junior Senator Obama in Washington, and before that, legislative Obama in the politics of Chicago in Illinois, was talking about clean coal. In fact, he had a lot of articles. If you go up and Google it, you'll see how many times he was sponsoring clean coal, movement to nuclear as our clean energy, and gas as a clean burning fuel. So he was aligned with coal, nuclear, and gas, but not with solar, wind, or geothermal, or other natural forms. And in fact, when I took a look recently at how much money has been given by this administration to many industries, just the nuclear industry alone, it is just staggering. It is over $27 billion in guarantees. And they're still not backing off the idea of clean coal. Now, I come from West Virginia. Now, I lived in Wheeling, West Virginia, Weirton, West Virginia, where you have Weirton Steel, and up there you got Pittsburgh Steel in Wheeling. And I have a lot of friends and family who have lived in Appalachia, and you drive down through Appalachia now, you're going to see a different Appalachia than what many people might assume, all because of coal. Could you take us through a history of this and also then give us your opinion on the idea that we can develop or should develop clean coal?
Well, yes, and it, as you started out with the president, it is perplexing, except for the fact that one has to recognize that Obama comes from a coal state of Illinois, and one has to wonder how much his stance on these issues is politics and how much is what he really believes, especially if you look at his, you know, the staff of his administration in the Energy Department. He's got around him some of the best minds that are dealing with global warming and future energy, and yet you're absolutely right in your litany of what the Obama administration has supported so far in terms of maintaining support for the fossil fuel industry and promoting and not promoting enough renewables. On the other hand, his administration has, with the stimulus package, put much more money into renewable energy than any previous administration except for Jimmy Carter's. But the power of the fossil fuel industry is pretty staggering, and it's a political power because the we call it big coal, but in fact the coal industry isn't really that big, but it does exercise a disproportionate political clout, especially in coal states like your home state of West Virginia. In fact, the whole economy of West Virginia is so dependent on coal that its tax system is really based on the way they tax the revenues from coal. So it's pretty hard to see how West Virginia could make a big shift away from its over-reliance on coal towards renewables without doing a massive legislative kind of overhaul. But, you know, to go back, as you say, coal has been a crucial source of energy. It is single-handedly the most important energy source in getting us into and through the Industrial Revolution before the exploitation of oil. Coal still provides nearly 50% of our electricity today. Each American consumes the equivalent of about 20 pounds of coal per day. It's hard to imagine, and I think many Americans are really unaware of that. They think, all the coal mining goes on in Appalachia, where you're from. In fact, the bulk of our coal now comes from vast open pit mines in the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana. There's this feeling that, you know, coal jobs are crucial to our economy, especially, which is pretty true in West Virginia, but the number of coal jobs has been decreasing dramatically over the years. One thinks of this as just a purely jobs issue. The amount of coal mined in this country has doubled since 1973, while the total number of coal mining jobs has been cut in half. And that's largely because of the new massive industrial-scale mining techniques like the notorious mountaintop removal mining, where they lay off a ton of miners who were doing these underground mines and put a couple of guys on one of these vast machines that does these massive drag lines scraping off the top of the mountain, dumping it into the valleys where they plug up the natural spring streams that provide the drinking water, and it's just a very wasteful process. And so coal has brought us this far, but it is the dirtiest fuel around, from the mining process, as I was just talking about with mountaintop removal, the environmental devastation there. Then you have the burning of coal releases all sorts of toxic metals, mercury, nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide lead to ozone, particulates, which cause 24,000 premature deaths per year, has a massive cost for just the air pollution. And there's the storage of the coal waste, the coal ash. That's the stuff that, you know, caused that huge, awful flood in Kingston, Tennessee last year. Mining disasters, which we've had. The Chileans are experiencing that right now. It's occupational safety problems, and then the global warming problem. Coal accounts for 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions in this country. So it's almost 50% of our electricity. It's the largest single source of CO2 emissions. It's carbon dioxide. In China, it's 80% of their energy and something like 70% of their carbon dioxide emissions. And China now has eclipsed the U.S. as being the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases worldwide. But still, Americans, each American consumes about three times as much carbon dioxide or, you know, as energy that emits carbon dioxide as each Chinese citizen. So, you know, they're still coming. They are bringing millions and millions of people out of poverty and the 19th century, really, in their quest for modernization. So they're going through the Industrial Revolution right now that we've already been through. So it's, you know, on one level it's a bit hard for us to say, you know, China, you should stop burning all this coal. You know, we are the ones that put up that all the CO2 in the atmosphere that is causing such trouble now. So, I know, Gary, that's sort of a wandering answer to your
but
good question.
It's a good overview. Your documentary draws a comparison between walking through all the steps, beginning with mining coal to actual energy production, is similar to visiting a slaughterhouse. So I'd first ask you to take us on this tour to show us just how environmentally devastating the coal industry actually is.
Yeah, it's at its most devastating in the mining process. It's the mountaintop removal that's the most devastating. The underground mining is not nearly, doesn't have as nearly as much of an impact on the environment, but it's by no means clean. I mean, there is this thing called acid mine drainage. And when water gets in these mines, it leaches out these toxic metals that are, have been safely, you know, buried under millennia of sediment. And when exposed to the open rain, that stuff, very toxic stuff, leaches into the water supply. Then there's the, all the storage problems of the ash, coal ash and stuff, that it's the same whatever kind of mining you do. So the mining process itself is very, very destructive. And in fact, it releases a lot of carbon dioxide just carving up the of the earth. Then there's the health effects of the burning of it, and then there's the problem what to do with the residual ash, the waste. And so at each stage in the process, there are environmental problems. Now, we have the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is there to regulate this industry, supposedly. For the last 8 years, during the Bush administration, the EPA was basically hogtied. They did very little. And they allowed permits for a lot of this mountaintop removal, which many people of arguing have argued is in many ways a violation of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Clean Water Act in particular, because of the way the mining process dumps the residual overburden, they call it, into the surrounding valleys and covering up all these water supplies. But the Bush administration and under the EPA under the Bush administration basically looked the other way. And a couple of very conservative judges had some very questionable rulings. But the political process down in West Virginia is such that, you know, we had the famous pictures of Don Blankenship, the notorious CEO of Massey Energy, which owned the mine that had the latest disaster. He was photographed on the Riviera partying with the judge on the state Supreme Court who was actually hearing cases against Massey. So there is a lot of corruption in the coal industry and the political system. So that also makes legislation and makes hogties regulators. Now under Lisa Jackson, the EPA has already taken very forceful steps, although there was some questionable permitting of additional mountaintop removals right after the Obamas came in. But now they are really standing firm, and it's pretty clear now, because of the Senate's failure to pass any kind of energy or climate legislation so far, and with the midterms coming up and the last 2 years of Obama's first you know, term, you know, it's very unlikely we're going to get a carbon legislation out of Congress. And that's a problem because many people would argue that you can't encourage industry to come up with solutions to creating greenhouse gases unless you put a price on carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has backed up the Environmental Protection Agency, which has had an endangerment finding. They have found that the EPA has issued a finding saying that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and endangers the human community. So under that, the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide emissions, and Lisa Jackson has said very forcefully she will do so. It is now up to them to try to rein in the industry. And so what is at stake? Are the idea of new coal plants going up? What kind of coal plants will be built? How are we going to meet our energy needs? And that's really the question that really faces us all now in the wake of the Senate's failure to take any action.
Okay, two last questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched so many ads on CNN, sponsored by the coal industry, which seems to be losing the argument that clean coal is only one part of the process, but that the huge tracts of land that you referred to, out west, for example, will still be laid waste by mining and mountains removed in the east, and the use of many toxic chemicals and the release of toxic particulate matter into the atmosphere and slurry pits. And all this represents an environmental devastating impact that just doesn't seem to bother too many people. So the bottom line is, you have CNN and others that do not do the original investigative reporting, which they're fully capable of doing, that would then challenge them. Why aren't the major networks not out there with major stories showing that these are really corrupting practices and are not going to bring us to a place where we need to be as a society, and especially in caring for our environment?
Well, that's an excellent question, Gary, and it really begs a whole show on what's happened to our mainstream media. But I will, first of all, I think we should, I failed earlier to address what you meant when you said clean coal, which is a big factor in my film. First of all, there is no such thing as clean coal. What is referred to, what one has to assume they're referring to when anyone says clean coal, is this technology called carbon capture and sequestration. And it's very technical, but in a nutshell it means let's put a filter on the coal plant and filter out the carbon dioxide before it goes out into the air, into the atmosphere. And there are many different kinds of techniques for absorbing or capturing that carbon. And then the idea would be to bury that carbon dioxide in deep geological sediments. And, you know, carbon dioxide is a gas, but when you compress it, when you highly compress it, it goes into a supercritical liquid state, and you can indeed pump it down, you know, like 1 or 2 miles deep. And they have been doing that, you know, since the 40s or 50s in Texas, you know, because they use the CO2. They inject it into old oil wells. And, you know, when you drill for oil, there's usually about 30% of the oil you can't get out. They use the CO2 to, it mixes with the oil, makes it less viscous, and they can pump it out. So they know that the geologists and the engineers know the technology of burying CO2 very deep. And they know that if you put it in an absorbent layer, a sandstone-like porous layer of rock, and then you have a cap rock on top of it, that will prevent it from leaching upwards, it will stay there. In fact, it will bond chemically with the stone and form a kind of a limestone and stay down there. Now, the question is, so yes, I do believe that carbon capture and sequestration can technically work if it's done properly in the right geological area. But we have some 8,000 coal plants worldwide, and if we are going to have any effect on global warming, you're going to have to do that to every single coal plant in the world. And many of them aren't anywhere near this kind of geology, so you'd have to put it into pipes, and this is a very corrosive material, CO2, and pump it hundreds of miles away. We are right now, we're pumping CO2 from northern Nebraska up to Saskatchewan, and I did some filming up there. And they're pumping it into old wells and to get the oil. It's called enhanced oil recovery. And then they're doing a prototype experiment up there where they're also sequestering it, trying to keep it down there, seeing how well it stays down there. And very early into my reporting, I found a ranch family who was living adjacent to this area, and they lived in a town called Goodwater, because that's what they named it. Water was so pure when the railroads were coming through, and their wells were always crystal clear water, and now they've had to abandon their ranch because something has been getting into their water supply. And it looks like the kind of problems we can expect with carbon capture and sequestration, which is not unlike hydraulic fracturing, you know, buried, like what you hear about the natural gas. Burying the stuff underground can be done, but it has to be done really carefully and well, and we can't always trust industry to do that. So in a nutshell, that's what clean coal is about. But the problem there is, when you capture CO2 from a coal plant, you decrease the plant's efficiency by up to 30%. And so what it will mean is you'll actually have to burn 30% more coal to get the same energy from that clean coal plant. So in other words, clean coal technology means mining more coal. And it means an infrastructure of piping and compression and tankers and all the stuff we associate with the petrochemical industry. It's going to require an infrastructure that's, by some estimates, 10 times as large to do that to all the coal plants. So one has to ask, how expensive is this clean coal going to be? And we're already, the Obama, you know, the stimulus bill, actually the Waxman-Markey bill that didn't pass but passed in the House, put $60 billion up for clean coal. We are putting billions of money into a technology that has not been proved commercially feasible, and the industry itself admits won't be ready for 10 or 15 years. So, yeah, raises a lot of questions.
Peter Boyle, I thank you very much for coming on, and we look forward to watching what happens, and hopefully people will take the chance to read the work you do. You can go to the website dirtybusinessthefilm.com, or you can watch the film Dirty Business, Clean Coal, and Our Battle for Our Energy Future. And I'm sure they can get the same information where to get the film on the website. All the best to you in all your efforts, Peter.
Thanks very much, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Go to GaryNoll.com. Listen to the programs you've missed. We have a lot of commentary has been doing against the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, the lies, misinformation that we've been fed, the lack of objectivity in our national media to cover these stories. But that's what we do. Have a nice day, everyone.
I've heard people say that too much of anything is not good for you, baby. But I don't know about that. Many times that we've loved and we've shared love and made love.
The Gary Noll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kempf. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.